It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to 538's Harry Enten about the biggest national political stories.
First, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with Russian President Vladimir Putin today after waiting for much of the day to see if the meeting would actually happen. Tillerson landed in Moscow yesterday for his first meeting with Russian officials. These meetings come at a time when the U.S. and Russia are using harsh words against each other about last week's chemical weapons attack in Syria and the U.S. airstrikes launched in retaliation.
Nihal Tusi joins us now to talk about this diplomatic visit and what's happening with U.S.-Russian relations. She's a foreign affairs correspondent at Political. Nihal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we know that there have been meetings today, but let's start with comments Secretary of State Tillerson made ahead of his trip to Russia. And here he is at a meeting of G7 foreign ministers on Tuesday talking about Russia's failure to rid Syria of chemical weapons.
Stockpiles and continued use demonstrate that Russia has failed in its responsibility to deliver on its 2013 commitment. It is unclear whether Russia failed to take this obligation seriously or Russia has been incompetent. But this distinction doesn't much matter to the dead.
What do you make of these comments?
Well, they're pretty harsh comments. They're very strident, especially from a Secretary of State who doesn't really talk much and doesn't really say much in public at all. So he went into this meeting, with his eyes wide open, and the Russians, at the same time, didn't really budge on their side of things either. They're not even willing to acknowledge that the Syrian president was behind these attacks. So I think you're going to see a very hard positioning going on both sides.
And we just learned that Russia has just vetoed a UN resolution that would have required Syria to cooperate with investigators on these chemical weapons attacks. Take us into this self-interest of Moscow here to cover for Assad. Explain to us why Russia is so supportive of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
Well, Syria is basically Russia's only real ally in the Middle East. There's an important water port there that the Russians use. They've long had a relationship with the Syrian government, which has basically been Assad or his father for the last several decades. They just kind of consider him an ally. I think that when they, and also just generally speaking, the Russians are not big on regime change or anything that, leads to instability in areas where they feel that their interests are at stake. And so this was a situation where this began back in 2011 with the Arab Spring, and what was basically a protest movement quickly turned into a civil war that's really spiraled out of control. And so when the Russians first supported Assad, and they have this whole time, I don't think they necessarily expected it to get to the level that it has or to last so long, and yet it has. But they are for geostrategic reasons, philosophical reasons, and I think also simply, Vladimir Putin's unwillingness to back down in the face of U.S. demands, continuing to keep up their support.
Why are they so dug in over having a regime change? Why does Moscow not support seeing any type of regime change?
Well, there's some people who believe that Putin doesn't necessarily like Assad, like on a personal level, that they don't think he's the smartest guy, that in recent days in particular, they feel like he has made them look really foolish by staging these chemical attacks, even though they deny that he did it. So there is that out there, but I think part of the challenge, too, is that the Syrian government is basically run by Assad and his family, so trying to get rid of them could actually lead to more instability now at this stage if you don't have a proper group of people or a person who can take Assad's place. I don't think Assad is willing to leave, no matter what Russia tells him. Mm-hmm. And so there's just all these different factors where they're looking at this and they're thinking, well, to us, he still seems like the best option. One of the things that Russian officials also tell me is that one of the reasons that they feel like the U.S. should take their concerns more seriously is that even if Assad is toppled, that afterward you're going to have a lot of continued violence, not only from terrorist groups, but reprisal killings from people who supported Assad going after rebels who they claim attack them and kill members of their families. And so they just feel like things will get even less stable in Syria than they are now.
We're talking right now with Nihal Tusi. She is a foreign affairs correspondent at Political. We're talking about the diplomatic visit that is happening right now between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and President Putin and what's happening with U.S.-Russian relations. Let's probe U.S.-Russian relations. Do you think it's possible, Nihal, for the U.S. and Russia to find common ground when it comes to the civil war in Syria?
I mean, I think it's possible. I think anything is possible. I just don't know that at this stage it's going to happen anytime soon. You know, when the Trump administration first took office, they really wanted to find ways to work with the Russians on everything. And part of that, I mean, just days ago, you know, Tillerson and others were saying, essentially, like, we're not going to worry about what Assad's future holds. Removing him is no longer a priority. But the chemical attacks have really scrambled the equation. And so the Trump administration, in deciding to stage a missile strike to retaliate over Assad's chemical attacks, has really, really changed the conversation, because part of it, too, is that they feel like the Russians are not willing to accept the reality that the U.S. is finding through its own intelligence reports. So it's become a situation where, you know, there was hope on some sides that Russia and the United States would get along better under the Trump administration. But, you know, it's not only Russia and the U.S. that are actors in this drama. Assad has his own point of view and his own interests, and there are others who would prefer that the two sides not get along. So it remains to be seen. But I think at the end of the day, like, both sides, and they both said this today, is they understand that they can't stop talking. Even during the worst parts of the Cold War, the Soviet Union and the United States still had a channel of communication. And so this is a situation where they're going to keep talking, but at the end of the day, they also have very different interests. So we'll see what happens. But it's really fascinating to watch the dynamics, because, you know, Trump, I don't believe, just quite knew what he was getting into when it came to Russia and Syria in particular.
Do you think this relationship between the U.S. and Russia will benefit from Tillerson's trip to Moscow?
I think it was a very awkward trip, but in a way it was very predictable. I mean, they stated that they had found some common ground on certain things, like fighting terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. But overall, neither side really budged from its position. And the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who's a bit of a legend, he really took a lot of digs publicly at Tillerson. At one point, he was like, you know, Rex Tillerson told me that he's kind of, he's not big on thinking about history, and he just kind of wants to deal with now, but you have to think about history. Mm. And it was just kind of this weird little insult and a dig in a very public way. And that's a sign that, you know, they're not willing to go down, you know, and do whatever the Secretary of State says. Now, that being said, you know, President Putin did meet with the Secretary of State. And that was a sign that, yeah, you know, they're not willing to completely abandon this relationship, because he could have snubbed him, and that would have been pretty ugly.
How close are we to any type of heated military tension between the U.S. and Russia?
Oh, I think both sides are pretty eager to avoid that. Okay. I mean, one of the things that they announced today was they're going to resume what's known as the deconfliction channel, which basically helps them coordinate U.S. and Russian aircraft above Syrian skies or in Syrian skies so that they don't collide. I mean, that's one indication that they really don't want to have a dead Russian or a dead American to be blamed on either side. So I think that that's the notion that the two would go to some sort of a military conflict against each other directly is a bit far-fetched at this stage. Neither side really has an interest in doing that.
Nihal, as we wrap up, what are you keeping an eye on here as Tillerson wraps up this visit to Russia? What are you watching for?
Well, I think what I would like to know is what Assad is going to do next. How quiet is he going to get? Is he going to use chemical weapons again anytime soon? And if he does, how will the Trump administration respond? That's really, really important. I mean, because the first strike, sad as it is to say, it's kind of an easy decision. But it's the second, third, fourth missile strikes from the U.S. or other military action by the U.S. that really could tell us where things are heading.
Nihal, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She joined us to look at U.S.-Russia relations as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson makes his first visit to Moscow. Right now, it's time for our Week in Washington segment. We're recapping the biggest headlines of the week in national politics. After President Trump ordered airstrikes in Syria last week, there are significant questions about his foreign policy and how Americans might see him now.
Harry Enten is with us to talk about that and much more. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So lots to talk about, Harry. Let's start with the Syrian airstrikes, or the U.S. airstrikes on Syria. After the airstrikes, you wrote about whether it would affect public opinion. Is there a chance Americans might see President Trump more positively for taking action in Syria?
Well, it's possible. You know, if you go back over time, and a bunch of political scientists did exactly that, they studied basically foreign policy entanglements, and they found that roughly about two-fifths of the time, about 39% of the time, in fact, the presidents did see a bump in their approval rating, but more times than not, they in fact didn't. And I went through a list of ways in which why Trump's approval rating might go up and why it might go down, and it was very unclear whether or not he actually, this attack or this airstrike, met those criteria. So I think the neutral reaction is to say it probably won't go up, but it is possible that it does.
You talk about an effect called rally around the flag. What is that exactly?
Well, it's essentially when, you know, if the U.S. is attacked on its own soil following, say, 9/11, or we start a war, people tend to, quote unquote, rally around the president. That is, their approval rating jumps because Americans like to rally around their commander in chief. And it's something that we've seen throughout time, as I mentioned, 9/11 with Bush, Iraq with Bush, his approval rating when he started the Iraq war went up as well. So there is, of course, some possibility that that could happen here with President Trump striking the Syrian airfields. But again, that's not on the same scale as those attacks that I mentioned prior during the Bush administration, or when American soldiers killed Osama bin Laden. Barack Obama also saw an improvement in his approval rating. That's not on the same scale as this, though.
When a president does get a bump, is it lasting or is it more of a blip?
It's usually more of a blip. In fact, you could basically go back to George W. Bush's administration. You see this tremendous climb in his approval rating after the 9/11 attacks, and then it was basically just a downward trend through his administration with perhaps a slight spike up after we went into Iraq. But usually it's quick, usually it's a blip, and usually it isn't that large.
And this move did get some support from some Democrats. Do you think getting some bipartisan backing works in Trump's favor?
Yeah, you know, again, in the piece I mentioned five different criteria, and one of them was that Americans tend to react with greater enthusiasm when there's bipartisan support for an intervention. And indeed, Democrats, Democratic leaders in Washington, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, although they weren't exactly the most enthusiastic, they did in fact give at least preliminary approval for these strikes, with the understanding that if there were going to be further actions, then Trump and the Congress would have to have a nice little conversation. So, yes, that is a good sign for Trump that he finally actually did something that Democrats like.
On the other hand, this really kind of goes in the opposite direction of what he campaigned on, that he was not going to get the U.S. involved in unnecessary foreign entanglements, that it was America first, let's fix our problems here. Could he be doing better with people that he didn't do well with before, but the opposite with the people who supported him?
That, of course, is very possible. I guess the question that is somewhat more difficult to answer is why exactly do the people who perhaps wouldn't have supported him, wouldn't have supported a Republican candidate in the past, decided to back Trump this time around? Was it foreign policy? Was it his economic measures? If it was, in fact, foreign policy, then you could easily see a move like this, along with, you know, coming out and saying that NATO is no longer obsolete, like he argued during the campaign, that could, in fact, hurt Trump going forward.
We're talking right now with senior political writer and analyst from 538, Harry Enten. We're recapping some of the biggest stories coming out of Washington this week. And kind of part of the sideshow around the Syrian airstrikes, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer made a pretty big factual stumble yesterday. Let's take a listen.
We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to the using chemical weapons. So you have to, if you're Russia, ask yourself, is this a country that you and a regime that you want to align yourself with?
And, of course, Hitler did use gas chambers to kill millions of Jews and others during the Holocaust. When Sean Spicer was given a chance to clarify his earlier statement, this is what he said.
think when you come to sarin gas, there was no, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the, he brought him into the, to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
So, Harry, a lot going on in those two clips. So has this uproar settled down yet? And what was the response immediately?
Well, you know, this is the type of story that I think probably is a day or maybe 2 day long story, but is not one that will continue on. The response, obviously, from members of the press, such as myself, was sort of astonishment, because obviously most people who are in the press corps have studied history at least to some degree and understand what Hitler did with German Jews and gassing them in gas chambers. But Spicer, to his credit, did go on CNN later on and spoke with Wolf Blitzer and acknowledged that that Hitler had, in fact, done that. I think he was trying to make a larger point that Assad is not a good person and that there was a reason why the U.S. should, in fact, strike those airfields. I just think that he probably didn't quite think it through and came out sounding pretty stupid.
So let's move on to news that just broke today that President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, is registering as a foreign agent. What does that mean?
Well, I think it means, I think there are numerous ways that you can answer that question. But I think what it means is that, you know, in terms of the larger Trump, connection with Russia, Paul Manafort was one of those big connections. And that's part of the reason he registered as a foreign agent, was that his office essentially had done work with Russian campaigns in the past with people in Russia. And that there was a large belief, at least among Democrats, that there was a connection between Manafort and the Russians during the 2016 campaign. Now, this does not, in fact, say that, but I think it does give Democrats, or at least people who want to go after Trump, some more ideas that maybe there is more to this, that maybe Manafort was involved with the Russians. But at least right now, there isn't any sign that Manafort did anything illegal. It's just more that clearly he has a lot of connections with Russia, which we already knew about, and that he's done work and gotten paid by them. The question that we still don't know is whether or not he did work for them during the 2016 campaign and whether he made any connections with the Trump campaign. There's no sign of that, at least yet.
So just to be clear, when someone registers as a foreign agent, is it kind of retroactive? Is it looking at things they've already done? Or in general, is it looking forward to work that they're going to do?
It could be both.
Okay.
This is the type of thing. Oftentimes in Washington, we correct the record. It wouldn't be surprising, though, if he did do some work going forward for them. But, you know, that might be a little bit more difficult given how much spotlight is on Paul Manafort right now. This is not something I think Trump welcomes. But for now, it's just a small story insofar as it's something we're talking about here, but it's probably not something that leads the evening news or something that a lot of common people who aren't very involved in the news are talking about.
And finally, Harry, let's move on to the topic of sanctuary cities, especially since the airstrikes. There has been a little less attention on President Trump's immigration stances, but there's a recent development on President Trump's plans to kind of reel in sanctuary cities. Where are we at right now?
Well, essentially, ICE was publishing lists of who these sanctuary cities were and basically trying to call them out. This was a new development under Trump. It was not something that was being done really before, and it was, you know, Trump obviously is someone who didn't, during the campaign, was not seen as friendly towards people who were in the country illegally, wanted to ensure that their federal funding was at least going to be cut to these sanctuary cities. But this move, in which they're no longer publishing those lists, in fact, is the latest development in my mind that Trump is kind of backing away at least a little bit from some of his more tough rhetoric that we heard during the campaign, and is also an indication in my mind that he's getting reeled in at least a little bit, facing the realization in Washington that he can't get everything that he wants to get done.
I have to say, Harry, when I saw that under President Trump they have started publishing this list of sanctuary cities, one of my thoughts was that in a way it's advertising for people who might be in the U.S. illegally to know what communities would protect them.
I mean, that's certainly a possibility, right? Oftentimes things that we do in public office have backlashes at beyond our exact recognition. I will admit that Trump has a lot of strengths, but subtlety is not one of them. And to me, this is the type of thing that, of course, could backlash. One interesting thing to note is that many people who are in the country illegally don't actually live in cities. They live in suburbs. So when you publish a list like this, in fact, you could be giving them an idea, hey, this is where we should be going. So maybe there's some movement going on behind the scenes that Trump is recognizing this. But again, I'm not sure that he's necessarily involved in the day-to-day so much to see that. There's a lot of news that's on his plate, as we've gone through this entire discussion, very much clearly so. So this is just, to me, a very just another interesting thing, another interesting facet is we have a new president in office who is very different from the last one, and I think he's kind of learning as he's going along, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's more movement on some of his policy positions on immigration, on foreign policy, and on the economy as well.
Well, Harry, it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Okie dokie. Have a good one, guys.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us often to recap the week's most significant national headlines.
As we mentioned last week, 75 Wisconsin dairy farms were informed by Grassland Dairy that they would no longer be buying their milk. This stems from a trade issue between the U.S. and Canada that affects the market.
Representative Ron Kind is a Democrat representing the state's 3rd congressional district in western Wisconsin. He's concerned about the farmers who are being affected, and he sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Agriculture asking them to provide assistance to them. Representative Kind, welcome back to Central Time. Representative Kind, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So Grassland Dairy recently informed about 75 Wisconsin dairy farms that they would stop buying their milk and gave them less than 30 days' notice. What reason did Grassland give?
Well, this is a point of concern that many of us have been raising with not only the Obama administration, but the new Trump administration, that Canada has not been living up to their agreement under NAFTA, allowing more U.S. dairy exports into their market. Not so much trade tariffs as it is non-tariff barriers that are making it more difficult for us to be able to export dairy into Canada. And that is exactly what Canada is up to right now. And I've had numerous meetings with the new Trump administration trade team elevating this issue with them and asking them if they're going to do any type of renegotiation with NAFTA. Well, then our access to Canada as it relates to dairy and poultry has to be on the table, and Canada has to abide by what they had agreed to previously.
So for the farmers who have relied on Grassland to buy their milk, what are some of the immediate challenges that they're facing?
Well, the immediate challenge is they still have to milk every day, and they got to find a place for that product. So many of us have been reaching out to the various processors here in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, trying to find a home for this milk for these farmers to sell to. The problem is we are dealing with overcapacity right now in our own domestic market. It's one of the reasons why the last couple of years milk and dairy products have been so low price-wise. So this is going to be a struggle, but we've got to coordinate with everyone here in Wisconsin, make sure that these farmers have a viable purchaser for the product because, you know, the cow's got to be milked. This is a 24/7 operation. But it also highlights the danger of having just one source to sell your milk to. And that was the problem that Grassland got into as far as exports to Canada. If something were to happen with that market, then unfortunately these farmers are going to be struggling to find another alternative buyer for the product that they're making.
So basically, we've been talking about how Grassland gave these farmers very short notice, but it sounds like they were just passing along what they were in turn hearing from the Canadian government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we're trying to work with Grasslands now, but especially trying to increase pressure on the Canadian embassy and the Canadian government itself through the new administration and their new trade team. Again, I've met a few times with now Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who's been kind of President Trump's point person on trade. And in those meetings, I and a few others have raised the serious concern that we've had with Canada and what they've been doing in recent years and trying to find new creative ways of blocking the export of dairy and poultry products into the Canadian market from our producers here. And that's something that we need to enforce and look into and certainly make clear to Canada that we won't tolerate this type of behavior.
Representative Kind, you sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Agriculture asking for immediate assistance for the affected farmers. What specifically are you hoping to see?
Well, a couple of things. One is trying to find a viable market right now. I think that's the immediate concern, that these farmers have a different place where they could sell the milk that they are producing. And then secondly, again, elevating this issue to the highest level of government. So it's a government-government discussion with Canada to try to get them to change their behavior and tactics in this regard. Canada has a different system up there. They've got a supply management. They have quotas for their individual farmers. And if they exceed the quotas, they get penalized. So they're very protective of the type of dairy supply. But this is ultra-filtered milk. This is a different type of category, too, that Canada has been trying to take advantage of. And you know, that's what we're trying to accomplish here with the Department of Agriculture, but also the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, who is in constant communication with our Canadian counterparts.
We're talking with Representative Ron Kind. He represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He's a Democrat, and he is from western Wisconsin. It seems like there are many other businesses that would also rely on those farms continuing to operate and prosper. I'm thinking, for instance, of truckers and processors and banks that are holding loans and whatnot. Would any assistance that you're looking for and hoping you might see from the federal government maybe be extended to them as well?
Well, we're trying to find a quick market for this for the dairy products right now so we don't get too far downstream as far as jobs impacted. But, again, this is a reminder for us here in Wisconsin that production agriculture is still the number one industry that we do have as a state, employing more people directly or indirectly than any other business. And dairy is a key part of all that. But dairy, by its the very nature of the commodity, which is very perishable, is in a different situation from other farmers. And they've got to sell the milk. The cows have to be milked. And that puts them into a less enviable position when it comes to market leverage. I mean, the processors know they got to sell the milk too. They would like to have a steady, guaranteed milk supply. And that's why trying to find an alternative buyer right now is the top priority. But we have a farm bill that's coming up for reauthorization. I think this is another example of some of the things that we need to look into with the 21st century farm policy. What tools, what risk management areas can we empower farmers with so they have more control over their own future in situations like this? So that's something I'm planning on being heavily involved with, again, as a representative for one of the larger agricultural producing districts in the nation.
Representative Kind, you made the point earlier that this is not a new issue. This has been simmering well back into the Obama administration. Why do you think there hasn't been enough will to move on it in the trade and commerce areas of the government to avoid something like this happening?
Well, unfortunately, there was some movement on it. The Obama administration in negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was gaining more market access for dairy in Canada, something that Canada had agreed to do outside of NAFTA. And that was a very positive thing for our agriculture sector, but dairy producers in particular in Wisconsin. But of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was immediately rejected by the Trump administration. They didn't even look at the language of it, which was unfortunate because much of what they're talking to renegotiate NAFTA about was contained in the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
efforts I've been emphasizing with the new trade representatives for the Trump administration to look at that first. Look to what Canada and Mexico already agreed to do under the Trans-Pacific Partnership rather than trying to recreate the wheel all over again. And hopefully they will do that, because I think there was progress made, perhaps not as much as we would like initially, but certainly greater market access for dairy to Canada. But also, from Mexico's point of view, they had agreed to enhance labor protections, worker protections for their workers, environmental standards, human rights standards, a reduction of various tariff barriers that have made it more expensive for us to export into that market. But unfortunately, you know, trade got caught up in this political vortex, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership wasn't even allowed to come up for a discussion or even a vote. And this also involved most of the Pacific Rim, which is the fastest growing region of the global economy. It's a place where we need to be. We need to be competing. And I'd rather having us compete there under our rules than trying to compete with China's rules, which is basically what we've allowed to take place now with our withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
In fairness to the Trump administration, I would say that indications were that Hillary Clinton also was going to scrap the TPP. So we might be in the same position here, regardless of whether it's current President
Trump. Yeah, but we could have got this done last year under the Obama administration. Obviously, President Obama, having negotiated the agreement, was very much in favor of it. There was an opportunity last year still to take it up for consideration, even before a new administration, regardless of who it was, took place. And I think it was a missed opportunity, because we were elevating standards up to where we are as a nation in comparison to all these other nations around the Pacific Rim. And perhaps more importantly, we were the ones helping establish the rules rather than having China now establish those rules of trade in the region and us trying to work on the outside in and try to compete in what will ultimately be a race to the bottom now with no worker protections, no environmental standards, and the 18,000 tariff barriers that were going down to zero, making it easier for us to export into this fast-growing region. Those 18,000 tariffs remain in effect today, again, putting us at a distinct disadvantage.
And as we wrap up, Representative Kind, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that the National Milk Producers Federation said that this issue could extend to tens of thousands of dairy farms across the country if it's not resolved. Is this something that's on the radar in a bipartisan way in Congress? Are you talking to your colleagues about how to address this?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, we're going to be coordinating with the entire Wisconsin delegation this week, another letter to the administration, so it will be very bipartisan. I've been working with Republican colleagues in the Pacific Northwest and the New England area that have similar concerns. So, yeah, we're approaching this in a bipartisan way. We're trying to find a way to fix this with Canada. But Canada has known, and they've been put on notice for quite some time, that we have not been happy with their blocking of our exports, dairy, but also poultry is another key concern that we have. And I have raised this in my meetings with Canadian officials, from the ambassador to their parliamentarians that come to Washington or their trade reps. And but I think grassland really is the point of focus right now, because it's hitting us right now. The impact on our family farmers, and as you described, the ripple effect with the local economy is significant. So we're trying to accelerate all this stuff.
Representative Kind, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Congressman Ron Kind is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He joined us to talk about a letter that he sent to the USDA urging assistance for the 75 Wisconsin dairy farms that have lost the buyer for their milk.
Wisconsin's annual Conservation Congress meetings were held around the state this week. These gatherings allow the public to give input into the management of Wisconsin's lands and natural resources.
The meetings are held in every county of the state, and delegates listen to testimony given by members of the public. WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach joins us now to recap the meetings and the topics that got the most attention. Chuck, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So there were, I understand, 88 measures on the ballot this year. What were some of them that garnered the most interest from the public?
Well, first we should mention that all of them were advisory questions, so none of them were binding that will bring about a change in state law overnight or anything like that. They were first 38 or so were asking the public to comment on DNR items that are in the rulemaking process that will go to the DNR board as early as May 24th, could go later than that. And then the other 50 or so questions came through the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. Again, advisory, the WCC, the Conservation Congress, is the state-recognized citizen advisory body to the DNR. So I can go into some of the questions now if you want.
Sure, that would be great. What was the range of topics that were covered?
Well, quite a few. I mean, a lot of them were fishing and hunting and bullet size and so on. But there were also a lot of citizen initiative ones that dealt with pollution and so on. I mean, some of I would tell you that of the 88, I think I counted this afternoon, that 81 passed. Only 7 were rejected. Some of them are really interesting, like one of the ones that passed was listing the monk parrot, which is not native species. It's released pets, I think, down in the Chicago area. They're not established here. Listing the monk parrot as a depredating species under wildlife damage and nuisance control rules. Basically, it would mean people could get be able to destroy these monk parrots if they're ever found in Wisconsin without having to get the department, DNR's permission to do so first. But there are also questions that affected more a widespread number of hunters. For example, what passed was eliminating the fall turkey permit drawing in favor of over-the-counter issuance of permits. So important issues to hunters, maybe not as much as the widespread public, though.
Speaking of hunting, one of the issues that comes up fairly frequently is whether there should be a legal hunt of sandhill cranes in Wisconsin. Was that one of the issues this year?
Right. That was one of the questions in the Wisconsin Conservation Congress portion of the meeting, if you will. Some folks had brought back the issue again. As it's passed twice before, again, as an advisory question. This year's question sort of begins the give the legislature and DNR permission to go ahead with the preliminary steps to creating a sandhill crane hunt. That passed by only 300 votes statewide. Was one of the closer items. It passed in 52 counties, rejected in 18, and tied in 2. For example, it lost in Milwaukee County, but some of the counties up north where there are claims by farmers and others that sandhill cranes cause crop damage, it got a better reception. But again, that's an item that has to next go to the Wisconsin Conservation Congress annual meeting, along with about 48 other questions. They're meeting May 12th and 13th in Oshkosh, I believe. And then the Conservation Congress will decide whether to try to push this with the DNR and legislature. And again, so far we haven't had the sandhill crane hunt get very far. A lot of conservation folks are against it. The International Crane Foundation has raised questions. So I wouldn't bet on that happening within the next year, but it is, there is a sandhill crane hunt in a number of other states, so it could happen here eventually.
We're talking with WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach. He's based in Milwaukee and often covers environmental issues for WPR. So those 88 items that were on the agenda, Chuck, how do they make it there?
Well, again, to the Conservation Congress ones, they go through a process of meetings earlier in the last calendar year, last 12 months or so. Citizen groups will bring in initiatives. And I think what we've seen in recent years is some progressive groups or groups concerned about pollution and so on, that they're not getting satisfaction from the state legislature or the Walker administration. A number of them have gone through the Conservation Congress process to get this issue out into the public a bit. There was a question we previewed earlier this week about giving the DNR authority to suspend application for the study of pollution impacts of CAFOs. In other words, slowing permits down on CAFOs if there were tribal or a local government concern. That came from the Ashland area with concern over the proposed hog CAFO in Bayfield County. So again, citizen groups are bringing these questions forward. Whether they'll turn into law, I don't know, but at least gets things on the table for a while.
And CAFOs being concentrated agricultural feeding operations, is that correct?
Animal feeding operations.
Animal feeding operations. Mm-hmm. So those really large, sometimes shorthanded as factory farms. So these hearings are held in every county of the state. How well attended do they tend to be?
Well, this year they had about 5,000, a little more than 5,000 people came to vote. The DNR told me today that number was up a bit from last year, but it was more along the lines of their average figures that they've had over the years. These hearings have been going on for decades, and they are indeed advertised as a chance for the citizens to make a difference. Again, what happens next, I think the DNR and the Conservation Congress and others have to weigh carefully if there's been a big vote in favor of something and then they don't do anything to support that vote. That can be a way to turn off the public sometimes if the public vote is ignored. On the other hand, there are some things that if science or other questions come forward, then maybe there's a better reason to ignore some of the citizen initiatives. But it's sort of a delicate balancing act for the state to proceed on this, especially when there's been a big vote on something.
And Chuck, you said that the Conservation Congress meets, their annual meeting is in May. What happens between now and then with all of this information and opinion that's been gathered at all of these hearings?
Well, I think everybody's sort of tabulating and sorting through some of the results and looking at some of the county-by-county results because, again, there could be a big push coming from one part of the state and it's not so important to the other part of the state. So there'll be discussions and tabulations and discussions over liquids and, you know, refreshments and so on between now and then, I suppose. But, you know, again, the Conservation Congress items go before them in May 12th and 13th. These first 38 or so go to the DNR board as early as May 24th. I don't know if everything will be acted on that quickly or over the course of the summer or a little bit later in the year.
And what is the relationship between the delegates who are at these hearings and getting this feedback and, say, the DNR infrastructure? Who brings what to whom?
Well, it's my impression that there's a lot of informal meetings, and there's some ones set up between the DNR board, for example, and the Conservation Congress. The Conservation Congress often testifies at DNR board meetings. In fact, they do not have to go to the time limit that others have to because it's, again, the state-sanctioned or recognized advisory body. So there's often a close relationship between the Conservation Congress and DNR, but there have been some disagreements. There have been some times when the DNR has not acted on Conservation Congress policies, and again, the Sandhill Crane Hunt has not gotten very far so far. Whether that will change, that's one to watch.
And as we wrap up quickly, Chuck, are there issues that you'll be tracking closely as it moves forward in the process?
Well, one other thing that came up this afternoon was voted on Monday is that wolf protection groups are trying to remove dogs from Wisconsin bear hunting and other. And if the wolf hunt would ever come back, they don't want dogs to be part of that. And so there was actually support for efforts to curtail the use of dogs somewhat in some of these hunts. And that's one that we'll watch, especially if the federal government or the Congress reignite or restart the wolf hunt in Wisconsin.
All right. We'll have to leave it there, Chuck. Thanks for bringing us up to speed. Chuck Kornbach, WPR News.
As can happen, a social media post has developed a life of its own.
Teenager Carter Wilkerson of Reno, Nevada, asked the fast food chain Wendy's how many retweets he would need in order to get a year's supply of their chicken nuggets.
Wendy's is known for its fun and off-the-cuff social media presence. Its response to Carter Wilkerson was this: 18 million.
Well, the gauntlet had been thrown down. Wilkerson responded with, consider it done.
To put this in perspective, Ellen DeGeneres currently holds the record for the most retweeted tweets ever. Her star-studded Oscars night selfie has held the record since 2014 with 3.4 million retweets.
But Carter remains undaunted. His retweet has passed the 2.6 million mark, not shabby at all, making it the third most popular tweet of all time and the most popular so far this year.
Carter's dad hopes that if he's successful in this quest for 18 million retweets, the year's worth of chicken nuggets from Wendy's could be donated to a good cause.
Well, we'll be following that.
And we will, yeah.
I have to say, 18 million is a lot considering Ellen got 3.4, but you never know.
Yeah.
Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then a bipartisan bill is making its way through the legislature to help veterans. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.